Hello, Los Angeles.
Hello.
And welcome to another episode of K-Chung Radio's The Talking Show.
Chinatown's only talking show.
I, Steve Cato, have the pleasure of the company of my co-host.
Hey, Steve.
Nicholas, here in the studio. And we've got something really special for you guys today, and it happened in a really interesting way.
Very interesting indeed.
You all, of course, will be familiar with our guest today. He is certainly no stranger to anyone in Los Angeles, and certainly not even a stranger to anyone in California.
Or Austria, for that matter.
And in a way, this is sort of following a trend of extremely eminent Los Angelinos being on the show. Werner Herzog, of course, lives in the Palisades, moved to Los Angeles because of the film business here. Last week we had John Cage, also a very eminent Angelino, born here. And today we have someone who, again, like Werner Herzog, moved here from a German-speaking place.
Yeah, well,
but
I still don't know why he's here.
Well, he's an important guy, and it's a real coup for us to have such an important person give us so much of their time. After all, a fellow like this, normally this kind of time is pricey.
Yeah, or almost any time.
That's right, Nicholas. Pricey.
Very.
And I think, to be fair, this is really going way beyond the Henry Rollins level. So if you're listening at home, Hank, just think. When you finked out on us 2 weeks ago, just look who we've got now. Okay, Hank? Just check this out.
Yeah.
And I bet this guy can do way more push-ups than you can. Way more.
A ton more.
That's right. So I'm going to let Nicholas let the cat out of the bag. Nicholas, who's our guest?
Former bricklaying business owner whose business fared quite well during the 1971 San Fernando earthquake. Real estate investor, former restaurateur, and Planet Hollywood investor. The one and only Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's right. Former governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I always wanted to be an inspiration for people, but they never set out to be a role model in everything. I mean, how could I be when I have so many contradictions and cross currents in my life? I mean, here I am, a European who became an American leader, a Republican who loves Democrats, a businessman who makes his living as an action hero, a tremendously disciplined superachiever who hasn't always been disciplined enough, or a fitness expert who loves cigars, an environmentalist who loves hummus, a fun-loving guy with kid-like enthusiasm who is most famous for terminating and killing people on a screen. How would anyone know what to really imitate? People often assume that I should be a role model for all of those things. I mean, when I ride my bicycle around Santa Monica without a helmet, there's always someone who complains, what kind of an example is that? It's not supposed to be an example. It's not meant to be an example. Well, usually the objections to my cigars is that I've been a fitness crusader for decades. But I remember once in Sacramento, a reporter said, we zoomed in with a camera on a label of your cigar, and it said, Cohiba! That's a Cuban cigar! You're the governor. How can you flout the law? How can you break the law like that? I smoke it because it's a great cigar. That's what I said to him. And the same is with movie violence. I kill people on screen because it's great entertainment. And contrary to the critics, I don't believe that violence on screen creates violence on the street or in a home. Otherwise, there would have been no murders before the movies were invented. And by the way, the Bible is full of violence. I do want to set an example, of course. I want to inspire you to work out. Keep yourself fit. Lay off junk food. Create a vision. And use your will to accomplish it. I want you to throw away the mirror, for instance, like Sergeant Schreiber talked about, and not always look at yourself, but get involved in public service and give something back to the community. I want you to protect the environment rather than to mess it up. And if you're an immigrant, I want you to embrace America. In this ways, I'm very happy to take the torch and to be a role model for others. Because I've always had great role models myself, like Rich Park, or Muhammad Ali, Sergeant Shriver, Milton Berle, Nelson Mandela, Milton Friedman. They're all great role models. But it's never been my goal to set an example in everything I do. Sometimes I prefer to be way out there, shocking people. Rebelliousness is part of what drove me from Austria. I didn't want to be like everyone else. I thought of myself as special and unique, and not like the average Huns in France. Being outrageous is a way to succeed. Bodybuilding was a nowhere sport when I was Mr. Olympia or Mr. Universe. We were struggling to get media attention, media coverage. So I started telling reporters crazy things like pumping up your muscles was much better than coming. It was a crazy statement, but it made news. It created headlines. People heard that and thought, if working out is better than sex, I'm going to try it. And you know something, the next day people stood in line in front of the gym. No one could put me in a mold. When I was governor, and people would say, this is what other governors do, or you can't do that if you're a Republican, or no one smokes in the Capitol, it's not politically correct, I would take that as a signal and go the other way. That was always my style. If you conform, then the people complain that you're acting like a politician. The way we ran our office, the governor's office, that was unique. How I dressed, how I talked, I always would look for my own way of doing things. People elected me to solve problems and to create a vision for our state, yes, but also they wanted things to feel different. They wanted a governor and a governator. Of course, being different was right up my alley. I didn't have the same body as everyone else, and I didn't have the same car as everyone else. I always wanted to be different. I've never figured this all out. I'm sure that the shrink would have had a good time with all of this. Definitely Sigmund Freud, my fellow Austrian, who would have a good time just talking about my cigars. By the way, he smoked stogies too. But life is much richer when we embrace the multitudes that we all contain, even if we aren't consistent and what we do doesn't always make sense even to us. When I talk to graduating classes, I always tell a brief version of the story of my life and try to offer lessons everyone can use. Like, have a vision. Trust yourself. Break some rules. Ignore the naysayers. Don't be afraid to fail. Woven through the stories in this memoir are some of the principles of success that have worked for me. Turning liabilities into assets. When I wanted to star in movies, the Hollywood agents and the producers, they all talked to me and said, forget about it. My body and my name and my accent were all too weird. They said, a body like that will be used maybe in Hercules movies and people will be scared with the German accent and your name. I mean, no one would be able to pronounce it. It's too long. Forget all that. Instead of listening, I worked hard on my accent and on my acting, as hard as I've worked in bodybuilding, to transform myself into a leading man. With Conan the Barbarian and the Terminator, I broke through. The things that the agent said would be a detriment and make it impossible for me to get a job or becoming a leading man, all of a sudden made me an action hero. Or as John Milius said, he was the director of Conan the Barbarian, if we didn't have Schwarzenegger, we would have to build one. When someone tells you no, you should hear yes. Impossible was a word that I loved to ignore, especially when I was governor. They said that it would be impossible to convince Californians to build a million solar roofs and to reform healthcare and to do something decisive about global warming. Tackling these challenges appealed to me because no one had been able to do them before. The only way to make the possible possible is to try the impossible. If you fail, so what? That's what everyone expects. But if you succeed, you make the world a much better place. Never follow the crowd. Go where it's empty. As they say in LA, avoid the freeway at rush hour. Take the streets. Avoid the movie theaters on Saturday night. Go to the matinee. If you know the restaurant will be impossible to get into at 9, why not go for an early dinner? People apply this kind of common sense all the time, and yet they forget when it comes to their careers. When every immigrant, for instance, was talking about saving up to buy a house, I bought an apartment building instead. When every inspiring actor was trying to land bit parts in movies, I held out to be a leading man. When every politician tried to work his or her way up the ladder from the local office, I went straight for the governorship. I think it's easier to stand out when you aim straight for the top. No matter what you do in life, selling is part of it. Achieving my goal of becoming Mr. Olympia was not enough. I had to make people aware that there was such a thing as a competition for the most muscular man in the world, that there was such a thing as Mr. Universe, Mr. World, Mr. Olympian, all those titles. I had to make them aware of what training does besides creating a muscular body. I had to make them aware that fitness promotes health and enhances the quality of life. This was about selling, communicating. People can be great poets, great writers, geniuses in the lab. You can do the finest work, and if people don't know, you have nothing, absolutely nothing. And in politics, it's the same, no matter whether you're working on environmental policy or education or economic growth. The most important thing is to communicate with the people and to make them aware. Now, every time I meet a great person, and I never pass up a chance, I try to ask how they made good and to figure out the angle that has worked for them. I know that there are 1,000 keys to success, and I love distilling new rules from my experience and theirs. So here are 10 principles that I want to pass along. Never let pride get in your way. Muhammad Ali and I did a lot of talk shows together. I always admired him because he was a champion. He had a great personality. He was generous and always thoughtful towards others. If all athletes would be like him, the world would be much better off. So he and I would meet in green rooms before we did our shows, and we joked around always. Once he challenged me to shove him against the wall, if I could. I think that someone in boxing must have told him that he should start lifting weights like George Foreman, because Ali was more known for his speed and his psychology. He was thinking about maybe adding a little strong like a bull to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. And he wanted to see how powerful a bodybuilder really was. I was able to shove him to the wall, and he said, "Wow, this weightlifting stuff really works. Cool, man, this is really cool." The next time I saw him, he had some buddies with him, and he said, "Watch this, guys. Hey, Arnold, try to push me again." This must have been a setup, I thought, because nobody wants to be pushed around in front of his friends. I started pushing Ali and backed him up all the way to the wall once again, and he said, "I told you guys, you see, I told you guys, this guy here is really strong. This weightlifting stuff really is good. It works." He didn't care about losing a pushing match. He just wanted to show his friends that resistance training, weight training, really worked. It gave you stronger legs and hips, and it could be useful for boxing. Don't overthink. If you think all the time, the mind cannot relax. The key thing is to let both the mind and the body float. And then, when you need to make a decision or hit the problem hard, you're ready with all of your energy. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't use your brain. But part of us needs to go through life also instinctively. By not analyzing everything, you get rid of all the garbage that loads you up and bugs you down. Turning off your mind is an art. It's a form of meditation. Knowledge is extremely important for making decisions, for a reason that's not necessarily obvious. The more knowledge you have, the more you're free to rely on your instincts. I mean, you don't have to take the time to learn about the subject. Yet in most cases, people who have the knowledge get bogged down and frozen. The more you know, the more you hesitate, which is why even the smartest people blow it big time. A boxer brings a huge amount of knowledge to the ring. When to duck, punch, counterpunch, dance back, block, and on and on and on. But if we were to think about any of this when a punch comes, it will be over. He has to use what he knows in a tenth of a second. When you're not confident of your decision-making process, it will slow you down. Overthinking is why people can't sleep at night. Their mind is racing and they can't turn it off. Overanalyzing cripples you. I remember back in 1980 when Al Ehringer, my partner, and I wanted to develop a block at the end of Main Street in Santa Monica. The investors that we were bidding against for the property let their worries hold them back. We had done the research too and realized that there were uncertainties that might limit the upside potential. The land was an old trolley right away and wasn't available for sale, just for long-term lease. Then land nearby was contaminated with chemical waste. Suppose this land had the same problem. The property straddled the border of Santa Monica and Venice, so it was unclear which local tax laws and regulations applied. We didn't dwell on these challenges, but the rival bidders did, and after a while, all they could see was red flags. So they dropped out when we raised our bid, and we got the property. Within 2 years, we were able to convert the lease into a purchase, and our gamble started to pay off. 3110 Main Street turned out to be a phenomenal investment. Now, many movie deals are made under pressure, and if you freeze, you lose. I remember on Twins, we had a deadline. Universal Studios needed to know if Danny DeVito and Ivan Reitman and I were all committed to this project. There was no time for the agents to dialogue. Danny, Ivan Reitman, and myself made the deal on a napkin in a restaurant during lunch. We all signed it and we left the table, and Danny, as a matter of fact, later on had it framed. I think we made more money on that movie than probably on any other movie, all in the shortest period of time, because we didn't freeze and we didn't overthink. Forget Plan B. To test yourself and grow, you have to operate without a safety net. The public opinion numbers were very low in early 2004 from a newly announced ballot initiative, in which we were asking the voters permission to refinance the $15 billion of debt that California had. Our budget experts were already wringing their hands. What are we going to do if these initiatives fail? We need a plan B. Why take a defeatist attitude? I said, if there's no plan B, then plan A has to work. We just announced the initiatives. There's a lot that we can do to get ourselves closer to the goal and to make it happen. If you're anxious instead of making fallback plans, think about the worst that can happen if you fail. I mean, how bad could it be? I mean, you quickly find out it's really nothing. If you fail at running for governor, for instance, you may be humiliated, but that is the worst that can happen. Think of all the presidential candidates who bow out. People understand that's how it works. I thought that if I would lose the election for governor, I would just go back to being in movies and make a lot of money. I would be a free guy, eating good food, riding my motorcycle, and spending more time with my family. So I did everything that I could to make it happen, putting the best team together, raising the money, communicating well, running an excellent campaign. If it didn't happen, I would just say, hey, it just didn't work out this time. When I did lose all of the ballot initiatives during the special election in 2005, it didn't kill me. Life went on, and I led a fantastic trade mission to China right after. And a year later, I was re-elected, and I was again governor of the state of California. My standard for misery is the guys who work in the diamond mines in South Africa when I visited in the 60s. The mines were sometimes like 1,400 feet down, and it was 110 degrees, and the workers were getting paid a dollar a day and were allowed to go home to their families only once a year. Now that's what I call being in deep shit. Anything better than that, and you're in good shape. You can use outrageous humor to settle a score. In 2009, my friend Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and the longest-serving assembly speaker in California's history, was hosting a fundraiser for the California Democratic Party at the San Francisco Fairmont Hotel. And he and I thought it would be really funny for me to drop by. So I showed up unannounced, and I gave Willie Brown a big hug. And a smooch. And we were hugging and doing kind of almost like kissing in front of everybody. Which, of course, freaked out half of the Democrats and made the other half laugh like hell. Then, a freshman state assemblyman from San Francisco named Tom Amiano stood up at his table and started heckling me. Well, he started screaming, basically, loud and obnoxious. I think he maybe had a little bit too much to drink. He started saying things like, hey, kiss my ass, kiss my gay ass, governor. The press wrote about it. Amiano was a professional comedian also, may I remind you. After his career as a comedian came to an end, he then became a politician. Well, I didn't make any comments about it and didn't make a big fuss about it. Very funny, ha ha ha. But in my mind I said, there will come a time when I'm signing bills, which is usually every September, when all the bills come down to my desk and I'm signing them or vetoing it. And so there will be a time where one of his sponsored bills will come to me, and then we will see what happens next. Sure enough, a few weeks later, I got one of Amiano's bills. It was a routine measure about the San Francisco waterfront, but it meant a lot to him. Oh, yes, I've heard it in the Capitol that this is something that really means a lot to him. So I instructed my staff to put together a nice veto message. It's very hard to explain. You got to kind of see it in a book. It is printed, the veto message. But they came up with a very creative way by writing each first letter of the line in such a way that when you read it down, it would say, fuck you. It started out, for some time now I have, and then it continues on. And then the next line says, unnecessary bills come to me. And then the next line says, care are major issues. And so the next line kicks the can down the alley. So we will find letters at the beginning of the line so that when you read it down, it just simply says, fuck you. So we sent it in, and it was considered like a veto message, like any other veto message. And the press didn't even pick up on it. So then someone from our office leaked it to the press, that you should actually look closer at that veto message. And so the press started looking closer at that veto message, and then they caught on. And then, of course, when we had the next press conference, they came to me and they said, Governor, this could not have been coincidental. You must have planned that veto message. And I said, no, I did not plan the veto message. I said, it's totally coincidental. Well, we went to an arts maker, and he said that the arts are like a 1 to 1,000,003 or something like that. And I said, why don't you go back to your art maker and have him figure out what the arts are to have an Austrian farm boy come over to the United States and win all the bodybuilding championships and became the greatest bodybuilder of all times. and then become also the highest paid actor of all times with $30 million. And then as a Republican marry into the Kennedy family. And then on top of that, out of nowhere, become governor of the great state of California and become kind of the second immigrant governor in the history of California. I said, now give that to the art maker. And then the journalist said, I got it. Okay, thank you. And then later on, of course, I said, of course it was planned. What do you think? You know, this was my way of kind of like having a little fun with that guy. So that's exactly what we did. So anyway, you have to see it in a book to actually see this video message. I just wanted to explain it to you kind of in an improvisational way. The great thing about the whole thing was is that Tom Amiano actually had a good sense of humor about all of that. I mean, he was quoted by a journalist as saying, in effect, look, I was a schmuck, so he has a right to be a schmuck too. It diffused the whole thing. And a year later, after signing into law another bill that he has sponsored, they issued a statement about it, which read vertically down, "You're welcome." The day has 24 hours. I once gave a talk at the University of California in the classroom, and it's something that was quite common as a governor to go to universities and to give speeches, but also to just talk to the students. And after my talk, a student raised his hand and complained, "Governor, since the budget crisis hit us, my tuitions have been going up twice already. I mean, when is this going to stop? Now, it's too high for me and I cannot afford it anymore. I need more financial aid, more assistance." So I said, well, I understand it's difficult, but what do you mean it's too high? Now, I have to work part-time in order to support the tuition. What's wrong with that? Well, I have to study. I am going to class. I cannot make it. I don't have the time to go part-time to work and do all that. So I said, well, let's figure this out. I mean, how many hours do you go to class? I've got 2 hours one day and 3 hours another day, he said. And how much studying do you do or have to do? Well, each day 3 hours minimum. Okay, so far I've 6 hours one day and 7 hours the other day, counting your commute and all that. What do you do with the rest of the time? I said to him. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, the day is 24 hours, as I said earlier. Have you ever thought about working more? Or since we have these extra hours available, maybe even taking more classes rather than wasting your life away, rather than complaining that maybe the government is responsible for your education and you have no responsibility? But the class was shocked to hear me say this. I'm not wasting my life away, he said. Yes, you are. You're talking about 6 hours a day. The day is 24 hours, so you have 18 hours left. Maybe you need 6 hours for sleeping. I mean, that's what I do. I sleep around 6 hours a night, maybe sometimes seven, maybe sometimes five, but an average of 6 hours. So if your part-time job takes 4 hours, you still have time for dating, dancing, drinking, going out and doing all kinds of things. Why are you complaining? I said. So I explained how I, as a student, I trained 5 hours a day for the Mr. Olympia competition or Mr. Universe competition and gone to acting classes in the evening from 8 to 11:30, almost 4 hours every day. I worked in construction several hours a day and gone to college and done my homework. I'd done all of that. And let me tell you, I explained to them, I was not the only one that was as energetic and wanted to do all this work. In my class at Santa Monica College and at UCLA Extension, there were people who were also working full-time, and still they went to school. It's natural to hope for someone else to foot the bill, and government should be there to help if there is a genuine need and to provide education. But if government is not taking in enough revenues, if the economy is down and if there's a recession worldwide, and no matter what you do, the economy is not picking up and you have now a shortage of $20 billion in revenues, I think there's nothing wrong with everyone taking a little haircut or everyone chipping in a little bit and making some sacrifices to make it happen. Plus, it is your education. I paid many times out-of-state tuition when I was going to college. I didn't mind it. Every penny I spent on my education and the great education I got in the United States, it was worth it. It was the best investment I've ever made. Reps, reps, reps. When you walked into the athletic union in Graz, where I lifted weights as a kid, to the left was a long plywood wall covered with chalk marks. That was where we wrote down our training program. We wrote it down each day. Each of us had his own little section on the wall. And before you undressed, you would make a list. I would go to my little space, and I would write down the day I'm going to do deadlift. So I would write down deadlift. Next to it, I would say 5 sets of 6 reps. And then next to that, I would just make then 5 lines that later on I would have to then cross off and turn them into an X. Then below I would write clean and jerk, 6 sets of 4 to 6 reps. Then again I would make 6 lines next to it. Then shoulder presses, 5 sets of 15 reps. Then I would make 5 lines next to it that I would have to cross off. Then I do bench press, 5 sets of 10 reps. Dumbbell flies, 5 sets of 10 reps. In the pullovers with a dumbbell, 5 sets of 20. And this would go on and on and on. I would sometimes do 60 sets, even though you didn't know exactly how much weight we would lift, but you would even put the weight down so that you have something to go by. Sometimes you didn't hit that mark, sometimes you did. So each time now you did a set of deadlift, I would cross off one of those lines and make it into an X. And then when all of the whole entire program was over, it would give you this great sense of satisfaction that you've now crossed off all of the lines, and the plan that you had when you came into the gym, you have now executed, and you've done all of the exercises. And it really made you feel great when you saw all of those lines in front of you being marked off. Writing out my goals became second nature, and so did the conviction that there are no shortcuts. It took hundreds and even thousands of repetitions for me to learn how to hit the 3/4 back post the right way, how to turn the waist in such a way that it looked the smallest, how to flex the calves and the thighs, how to flex the lats and the intercostals and the rear deltoids and the side lateral and the front deltoids, the biceps and the triceps. I had to have total control over the muscles. And the only way I was able to do that and at the same time smile was by doing the reps after reps and posing after posing, hour after hour. It was all about doing it over and over again. The same was with delivering a punchline in a movie, or dance the tango in True Lies, paint a beautiful birthday card, or say, I'll be back, just the right way. If you look at the script of my address to the United Nations in 2007 on how to fight global warming, here is what you will see. On top of the speech, many lines. They are in groups of 5, just like in a bodybuilding gym. 55 reps. That means the entire speech, which took around 12 minutes, I did that speech 55 times. Why? Because there was no second take. When I go to the United Nations and I speak to almost 200 countries, and I want to sell the idea of the extraordinary work that we have done as a subnational government in California, and I want to sell the idea of the power that local government has, and to inspire them to do the same thing, I better deliver a good speech. This is the only shot I have. So therefore, I believe that I should come as prepared as ever in anything. And it was a huge hit. If you want to be good in skiing, you have to get out on the slopes and you have to go from morning to night and do the reps and do the mileage. And that's when you get good. The more you ski the bumps, the better you will get with the moguls. The more you run gates, the better you will get with the gates. That's just the way it is. And if you play chess, you have to play tens of thousands of games in order to really understand and get good in playing chess. Or on a movie set, the only way that you will have your act together is to do the reps, to do take after take, and to do as many rehearsals as possible. You've done the reps. You don't have to worry about anything. You can enjoy the moment when the cameras roll. Filming The Tomb in New Orleans with Sylvester Stallone, we shot the scene with 75 people in a prison brawl. The choreography was so complicated, with dozens of fist fights and wrestling matches and prison guards coming in and clubbing people, that just the rehearsal alone took half a day. They did the rehearsal and the fight over and over to make sure that no one hit someone else accidentally, and that everything looks natural, and that everyone knows exactly what to do at any given moment. By the time we shot, everyone was tired, but at the same time, they were all really pumped up. The take was so successful, they only had to do one take. The moves had become second nature to all of us, and it really felt like a fight. So many reps were done that it ended up being a perfect fight scene. So as you can see, you need reps. The more you do it, the better it is. There's no shortcut. Don't blame your parents. They have done the best for you. And if you have been left with problems, those problems are now yours to solve. That's right. Maybe your parents were too supportive or too protective, and now you feel needy and vulnerable in the world. Don't blame them for that. Or maybe they were too harsh. Who knows? Whatever it was, don't blame them. Look, I loved my father when I was a little kid, and I always wanted to be like him. I admired his uniform, I admired that big gun that he always wore, and the fact that he was a police officer. But then later on, I hated the pressure that he put my brother and me under. You have to set an example, he would say. You have to set an example in our village because you're the children of the inspector. I demand that, he would say. We had to be the perfect kids, which of course we were not. We were far from it. We caused our trouble. We leaned ladders against people's doors. When they opened the door, the ladder smashed into their forehead. We did all kinds of things like that to come up with ideas on how to torture people. We were not perfect. He was exacting, which was his nature. He was also brutal at times, but I don't think that that was his fault. I think this just came because he was in the war. If he had lived in a more normal way, he would have been a different person. So I've often wondered, what if he would have been warmer and nicer to me? Would I have left Austria? Would I have been as hungry as I was? Probably not. And that is my fear. I became honored because of what he did to me. I recognized that I could channel my upbringing in a positive way rather than complain and to look back. I could use it so I could create a vision, to have goals, to find joy in my goals. His harshness drove me from the home. It made me come to America and work for success. I am happy it did. I don't have to lick my wounds at all. There's a passage near the end of Conan the Barbarian, one of my favorite movies, that has always stuck to me, actually. The line is said not by me, but by Thulsa Doom, the sorcerer who makes Conan as a young boy watch his father being devoured by dogs, and who slaughtered Conan's mother before his very eyes. As Conan is about to kill him and avenge his parents, Thulsa Doom says, "Who is your father if it is not me? Who gave you the will to live? I am the wellspring from which you flow." So it's not always obvious what you should celebrate. Sometimes you have to appreciate the very people and the circumstances that traumatize you. The day I hailed the strictness of my father and of my whole upbringing, and the fact that I did not have everything that I wanted in Austria, because those were the very factors that made me hungry. Every time he hit me, every time he said my weight training was garbage, that I should be doing something useful and go out and chop wood, and every time he disapproved of me or embarrassed me, It put fuel on the fire in my belly. It drove me and it motivated me. Change takes big balls. While I was on a trade mission in Moscow during my last year as governor, I took a little time out to visit former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, and it was at his home. We have become friends over the years, and I've given a speech for him and sat with him at his 80th birthday party in London just a few months before. Gorbachev's daughter, Irina, she made lunch for us and several of the friends from the Gorbachev Institute. We ate for at least 2.5 hours, and we talked about all kinds of things, and it was just wonderful to look around that library there and all the memorabilia and the photographs, and we talked about his wife, Riza. It was really fantastic. I have always idolized Gorbachev because of the courage that it took him to dismantle the political system that he grew up under. Yes, the USSR had financial troubles, and yes, Reagan outspent them, and they were backed into the corner. But for Gorbachev to have the guts to embrace change rather than further oppress his people or pick fights with the West has always amazed me. I asked, how did he do it? How could he change the system after getting indoctrinated from childhood to view communism as the solution to every problem, and after rising to his leadership in his party, where you had to show passion for the system all the time? How could he be so open-minded? He said, my whole life I worked to perfect our system. He told me that I couldn't wait to get to the most powerful position because I thought then I would be able to fix the problems that only the leader can fix. But when I got there, I realized that we needed a revolutionary change. The only way things got done was if you knew somebody or you paid someone under the table. So what system did we have really here? It was time to dismantle the whole thing, he said. Maybe it would take 50 years for people to understand his achievements. Scholars will always be debating whether he did it the right way. I'm not going to debate this. I'm not an expert on this. I just thought that it was great that he did it. I'm amazed by the courage it took not to go for immediate gratification, but to look for the best direction for the country in the long run. To me, Gorbachev is a hero. He's a true hero at the same level as Nelson Mandela, who overcame the anger and the despair of 27 years in prison. When given the power to shake the world, both of them chose to build rather than to destroy. Take care of your body and your mind. Some of the earliest advice that stuck in my head was Freddy Gerstel's channeling Plato. The Greeks started the Olympics, but they also gave us the great philosophers, he would say. You have to build the ultimate physical machine, but you also have to build the ultimate mind. Focusing on your body was no problem for me, of course, and later on, after I realized that it is so important to learn, I became really curious to develop my mind. I realized that the mind is like a muscle and we should train it too. So I was determined to train my brain and to get smart. I became like a sponge, absorbing everything around me. The world became my university, and I developed such a need to learn and to read and to take it all in. For people who are successful with their intelligence, the opposite applies. They need to exercise the body every day. Clint Eastwood exercises even when he is directing and when he's starring and when he's producing and when he's traveling around the world. He always is working out, and that's why he's looking so good and that's why he's in good shape. Or the president of Russia, now his prime minister, Medvedev. He worked endless hours throughout the day when he was president of Russia, but when I was there for the trade mission, we went together to the gym and we worked out for 2 hours, and it was fantastic. And I asked him, do you work out every day? And he says, absolutely every day. I get up earlier in the morning and do my reading, and I also do my working out. So if world leaders have time to work out, so do you. Many years after hearing it from Freddy Gerstl, I heard the same idea of balance from the Pope. I remember I visited the Vatican with Maria and her parents in 1983 for a private audience with John Pope Paul II. Sergeant Schreiber was talking spiritual talk because he was an expert in that. And my mother-in-law Eunice Kennedy Schreiber asked the Holy Father about what kids should do to become better people, and he said, just pray. Just pray. And I talked to him about his workouts. He was kind of stunned a little bit when I started pumping him for information about his workout and not any spiritual questions, but I was fascinated. Just before we went, I've read a magazine story that described how athletic the Pope was and what good shape he was in. To him, besides religion, life was about taking care of your body, both the body and the mind, actually, and the spirit. So we talked about that. He was known for getting up at 5 a.m. and reading newspapers in 6 different languages and doing 200 push-ups and 300 sit-ups, all before breakfast. He was a skier also. Sometimes people wouldn't recognize him because he was so incognito. But I think he must have been the first pope that actually went skiing while he was pope. He was already in his 60s, 27 years older than me. And I said to myself, if that guy can do it, if he can work out every day, I think that everyone can do it. And I also can make an effort to get up even earlier every day and kick some butt. Stay hungry. Be hungry for success, hungry to make your mark, hungry to be seen and to be heard and to have an effect. And as you move up and become more successful, make sure that you also be hungry for helping others. Don't rest on your laurels. Too many former athletes spent their lives talking about how great they once were 20 years ago. But someone like Ted Turner goes from running his father's outdoor advertising business, for instance, to founding CNN, to organizing the Goodwill Games, which are the world championships in athletics, to raising bison, to supply bison meat, to have 47 honorary degrees, and the list goes on and on and on. Now that's what I call staying hungry. Or for instance, Bono. He started as a musician, fantastic, talented musician. But then he started buying other music. Then he worked to combat AIDS and to create jobs and debt forgiveness and all those kind of things. Or Anthony Quinn, the famous actor, he was not just happy being a movie star. He wanted to do more. He became a painter whose canvas sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Or Donald Trump turned his inheritance into a fortune 10 times bigger than what he inherited. Then he started his own network TV show. Now look how big he is. Or Sergeant Shriver, my father-in-law, he traveled the world till he died, always hungry for new projects. I loved it about him. So many accomplished people just coast. They wish they could still be somebody and not just talk about the past. There's so much more to life than just being the greatest in one thing. I mean, we learn so much when we are successful. So why not use that for the connections and to do more with all those things? I mean, we can reach out, we can help our neighborhoods, we can have an effect if it is Special Olympics or after-school programs, or teaching a kid how to read, or to put some money into some local school or some programs. My father always told me, be useful, do something. And he was right. If you have a talent or a skill that makes you happy, use it to improve your neighborhood. And if you feel a desire to do more, then go all out, like I did with the governorship. And in my case, America gave me all the opportunities to become rich and famous and achieve my goals. So why not give back to the United States? I always say, we have plenty of time to rest when we're in a grave. Live a risky life and a spicy life. Like Eleanor Roosevelt said, every day do something that scares you. We should all stay hungry.
Wow.
That's right. Wow.
That was so profound.
Yeah. I was actually very touched, Steve. Very touched.
You know, I don't throw words like wisdom around casually, Nicholas. But
yeah.
Wow.
You do actually throw it around pretty casually. You use that word truth too much, yeah. Too. I mean, you're always saying that this is truth or that's truth, even when we're at McDonald's.
Yeah.
Too much. But I am curious, how did this whole thing come together? How did we bag such a pricey guest?
It's funny you ask, actually, how this got set up, Nicholas, because it was a coincidence, really. I was hanging out with LaVon Lambeth, for those of you joining us recently, former guest on the show, sort of a...
Shit. Not LaVon. Fuck.
Oh, well, a bon vivant, shall we say. And, you know, you just wouldn't believe the people LaVon knows. So I was hanging out with LaVon one day. We were cruising around in his Eldorado. And, you know, he said, oh, check this out. Come to my buddy Arnold's place. And, you know, he's got some really good drinks over there. And we'll, you know, it's always an interesting time. And it turns out that he actually does know personally the governor, and that they had arranged to, you know, go over and play pool together. And so I tagged along, of course, and I just couldn't believe it. And so, of course, you know, Arnold's an aspirational character, and he wants to know what you're into and what you're doing. And I told him about the radio show, and he thought that would be great fun. So he wanted to come out and, you know, bring his positive message back to the people of California. Tell a little bit of his side of the story, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what happens when you're an alcoholic socialite driving in Eldorado, hanging out at places like Planet Hollywood, LaVon.
Yeah, LaVon, I know. I know, it's crazy.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'm still hungover from my last LaVon hangout.
Well, Arnold's sort of twirling the keys for his Hummer, and he looks like he's about ready to go.
Yeah, we got to get him out of here. If Solomon sees that cigar, he's going to flip out.
See you later. And I think I'm feeling pretty tired, too. It's 1 in the morning. Time for bed. See you all later.
Good night.
Good night.